This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. I'm going to take a few minutes now and find out the latest involving the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana, which is now properly named Humane Indiana. It started out with other names. In fact, it actually started in 1940. Can you imagine it's been around that long? Well, it has been, with the animal shelter moving eventually to Munster and expanding from that point even into Porter County. And we have with us today Harry Vandeveld, who's the CEO of Humane Indiana, to talk about the operation, about the history that he's picked up along the way from a lot of veterans there at the animal shelter, who have taken care of lots of animals, and a future, too, of what the Humane Indiana is going to be like. Harry, thanks for joining us today.
It's fantastic to be here. Thank you so much for inviting Humane Indiana on.
Well, to go into the website, one of the pages that you see has just a few words on it, and maybe you can kind of fill in around the edges. It's on the what I guess you could call the history page of the website, and it says, founded in 1940, Humane Indiana's first animal shelter was a converted three-car garage. And I have to believe that's true.
Without a doubt, yeah. We are very proud of the fact that four women who saw a need and stepped up and acted were the really the four creators of the Humane Society of the Calumet area, which is what a lot of folks remember us as before we changed our name just 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. When the Humane Society of Calumet area got started back there in the 40s, I guess the emphasis, was it on the same things as it is today in 2019, or were things different back then when the shelter got its very, very humble start?
Without a doubt. Like a lot of other businesses, whether you're for-profit or you're not-for-profit, things change. And back in the day, it was more of a benevolent type of a act on the part of individuals to gather up pets and or discarded pets as they saw them in mm-hmm. Hammond, and to bring them in and to care for them. The 21st century form of animal shelters and what goes on in an animal shelter and in our case also a low-cost animal clinic are very reflective of the changing sea change that is occurring in animal welfare work. A big part of the change is, for instance, in the world of feral cats, mm-hmm. A lot of studies have been done recently, and in fact, the city of Highland has just adapted a HSUS and Humane Indiana policy that says if you capture feral cats, if you in fact spay and neuter them, and then place them back where they were from, the feral cat population will diminish over the course of the next 3 years just through sheer nature. And on the part of dogs and cats that we see coming in, we spend a lot of time in our counseling on the intake side in terms of diversion. We don't like to be seen as just a dumping ground for an animal. We like to work our way and counsel our way through a conversation with the owners of the animal to see what can be done to keep that animal from going into the shelter.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the things I think that people may or may not be aware of, especially if they're not familiar with the Munster-based animal shelter, the fact that it is split up between the administrative space, so to speak, and the intake space, as they call it, and then the place where animals are kept until they can find suitable homes. Has this been some evolution over time, because you moved out of that that three-car garage in Hammond sometime or another to the facility that's now standing in yep. in Munster. But what had happened? Where did things grow in between the two spots?
The organization, like a lot of not-for-profits, just slowly moved itself up, seeking low-cost facilities to be able to function out of. And then really the great moment in the history of the organization was through the benefactor, Mrs. Estelle Marcus. Mm-hmm. And Mrs. Marcus's gift not only created a bricks and mortar situation for the organization, but she also created an endowment that allows us to move forward, effect and advance our mission.
Now we know that Mrs. Marcus, as you say, they've named the building after her. It's been like that for quite some time. But when did the endowment take place? About the same time it all kind of happened, about the same. And as far as you know, it's kind of branched off where the building has grown over time and the endowment is there to help keep the operations
That's right.
going.
Mrs. Marcus had a beautiful vision for how to take care of, in particular, individuals who are in a marginalized position or needing assistance to take care of their animals. That's why the clinic is a low-cost clinic. Our pricing is drastically reduced from that of a regular veterinarian hospital. And she also, at the time of her passing, had the foresight and the vision to say that a gift would allow us to move forward and hopefully in perpetuity because of the generosity of her gift.
Well, you mentioned here that is important to note that the rules of adopting a pet no doubt have changed probably as much as the rules of accepting stray pets off the street, so to speak, or for even the police agencies and others that bring pets in on a regular basis. Things have changed. What seems to have been one of the major changes that you all at the Humane Indiana have noted?
Probably the most significant dynamic for us was we determined that it was not appropriate for us to just be a dumping ground for animals.
Right.
And with that being said, it meant that we had to change our way of thinking and how we worked with municipalities in Lake County, whether it be the city of Gary, Chicago, Hammond, Highland, who's been very progressive, and also the town that we are proud to call our home, Munster. We continue to seek opportunities to make sure that animal control officers are trained, that they're up to speed on the latest thought processes, and that if we can't take that animal into our shelter, that we make sure that that animal goes back to animal control with supplies and food that allows them to make sure that animal is in a better position for moving on to rescue.
Now, we know this may be changing by the time we finish the sentence. You never know. But where do we stand right now as far as animals that are spending their days at the shelter now?
We are really blessed to have a fantastic team. Brian Fitzpatrick and Jessica Patalis Hernandez and the entire team at the shelter do a great job of analyzing the animals that we bring in so that they are, in fact, for the most part, on a fast track to turn around and really leave the shelter within 4 to 5 days.
Wow.
Our goal is not to be a place where people think that we just warehouse animals that no one wants to have. Our job is to make sure that for whatever the reason that we are, in fact, in care of that animal, that we are turning that animal around after they've gone through a thorough, and no pun intended, vetting process. We're blessed to have great veterinarians. And when you come to our place, you'll know that animal has been observed and has been treated. We make sure the animals are vaccinated, spayed or neutered, and chipped. Then they're ready to go back out into a happy forever home.
Now, as we speak on Monday, the first day of April, approximately how many animals, dogs, cats, and otherwise are spending some time at the shelter?
Well, Jessica's been doing a fantastic job of working with the ASPCA, and we've been working on bringing some dogs up from the south, Mississippi. And we're probably, today the census is probably around 20 cats and 25 dogs. Mm-hmm. We try and make sure that although we have caging for up to 80 dogs, that we just don't, we don't get to that level. That's not appropriate.
I know. Yeah, I know that you've had times where you've had an awful lot of animals in the shelter, but you say everybody felt very uncomfortable about that in visiting. You don't like to have all that many animals around. Not that you don't like the animals. It's just that you know it's stressful on everybody. It's stressful on the animals and the people that take care of them while they're there.
Yep, exactly. We're blessed at Humane Indiana to have a phenomenal staff and an unbelievably robust volunteer corps. And we try and make sure that there's a good communication line about what we're doing and our philosophy and theory on intake and adoption. And I think everybody buys into that and realizes that we just can't warehouse animals.
I know we've talked here just briefly about, without going into great detail about the adoption process, but you say the goal that you have is to have an animal only in the shelter for about 5 days before it has a new home. And there's also a great benefit, too, that people may or may not be aware of, physical as well as psychological benefit to taking in an animal that has had another home and making a new home for it at your place. Something that's a stress reliever, I think maybe people are not necessarily aware of. Tell us about that.
Well, without a doubt, the science, the brain science behind having a pet around is irrefutable. When you have the opportunity to care for and love something that really will show you love back almost immediately for you bringing them into your home. I can't recommend enough for folks to be able to think about it, that addition to their family. It's a win-win all the way around.
One of the other services that Humane Indiana offers is a service that is you wouldn't think necessarily benefit the animals. It's not related to the animals, but it is in a way. It's a consignment store that's located in Highland, aptly named Paws. How did you all get involved in that, and what's the benefit that it turns over to Humane Indiana these days?
Oh, thanks, Chris. It's such a marvelous thing for us to be able to operate. The Highland Paws shop is the epitome of one man's junk is another man's treasure, I think. Mm-hmm. The Paws resale shop, I highly encourage everyone to come by Plaza Lanes on Kennedy Boulevard and see what goes on in there. We don't operate a little resale shop. Last year, we had a gross revenue of $253,000 in our Paws resale shop. That money goes right to the bottom line for caring for animals. It is an important revenue stream for us. It's a marvelous place for people to volunteer, and it's a great place for folks to come by and pick up quality items at a reduced cost. It's a great part of our entire fabric.
And aside to having this separate operation going to help benefit the animals in the end, I understand too that you've recent years set up an animal rescue operation. Tell us how that got started and how it fits in well with the goal and the mission of Humane Indiana.
Right, and so we changed our name specifically because of the addition of the Moraine Ridge Wildlife Center, as well as the education center that sits on the property in Valparaiso. 28 acres. Last year, just as a little side note, last year we saw 7,000 individuals in our education program. And the education program is built around and uses ambassador animals that come into the wildlife center. So last year, 23 counties in Indiana brought animals to our wildlife center for rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. And in fact, currently, we have a bald eagle in our flight cage that's going through rehabilitation and is very close to being let back out into the wild.
Oh, really? What's the story behind him?
Well, he had a broken wing and was found and brought to a veterinarian who works with us. That vet knows that after the care that they had given in terms of surgery, that we were the place because of our certified and trained rehabilitationists, that eagle is going to be able to go through the paces. They literally fly him 30 laps, according to doctor's orders, and get him up to speed. And they're getting ready to really see if he can get out and hunt. But that goes on a daily basis. Everything from squirrels and bunnies to bald eagles, snowy owls from the Arctic. those animals that cannot go back into the wild because they wouldn't be able to survive, whether they've lost an eye or lost a talon or aren't able to fly effectively, they become ambassador animals. Mm-hmm. And our educator, Nicole Harmon, does such a marvelous job going out into the public and really letting people see up close what a red-tailed hawk looks like and what a Arctic owl looks like or what screech owls look like and salamanders and turtles and snakes and fox, all part of our ambassador program. So in the Valpo area, we're really blessed to be able to rehabilitate animals, get them back into the wild, and then also do effective work in the education world. We'll see over 25,000 people this year in our new education program, and I encourage everybody to go to humaneindiana.org and click on the education tab and really see all the great things that are going on there.
Now, besides the new center that is set up in Valparaiso and the continuing work on animal rescue and what's happening, I guess, in Lake County in particular with the current operations at the animal shelter and also to the consignment store, if anyone's interested in, number one, finding out more about Humane Indiana, and number two, volunteering time, because you always take in volunteers in any of the locations, I understand.
That's exactly right. We would highly encourage everybody to go to in this 21st century, you go to the website, right? Go to humaneindiana.org. We'll be able to answer your questions there or put you in touch with the correct individual on the staff who can help you, whether it be wanting to volunteer or have an educator come out and speak to your child's class. It's all right there for you at humaneindiana.org or call one of the facilities and ask for Harry, and I'll gladly answer your questions.
Well, Harry, thank you for answering our questions today, too. We appreciate you stopping by and bringing us up to date on what all's happened, a little history lesson about Humane Indiana and how things are shaping up going into the rest of the 21st century. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
Harry Vandeville is the CEO of Humane Indiana. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, students these days have access to technology, to information, to opportunities like they've never had before, but they also have, unfortunately, levels of stress and anxiety and depression that have never been seen before. Well, that's the topic for this month's column from the guest coming up. It's Tammy Silverman. She's the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, and she's joining us from Indianapolis. Tammy, thank you for being with us today.
Always my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, where was the information come about here about something which is alarming, I suppose, maybe to some, but not to others?
Yes, you know, and I think we're hearing more and more. It came to our attention because of so many educators and after-school providers saying, gosh, our kids are really, really stressed out. And that's showing up, you know, and sometimes teenagers, sometimes it's hard to tell what's normal stress and what's concerning stress. And we're definitely hearing that it's turned more to things such as, you know, kind of that concrete anxiety and or depression, and sometimes it shows up even as far as suicide attempts and those kinds of things. So it's something that we need to pay attention to and that we know that teachers are paying attention to as well as our State Department of Education.
Well, I was going to say the State Department of Education has got some information that's come out here recently and talking about suicide in particular. Some of the things I note that they have said are not surprising. They've said this before, but they seem to be reinforcing the stats. Tell us what you've learned about it.
Yes. So right now, suicide is the second leading cause of death for Indiana youth ages 15 to 24, and the fourth leading cause for those ages 5 through 14. So that means one in five Indiana high school students, which is approximately 200,000 of our kids, have seriously considered or attempted suicide in the past year. So that's startling numbers, and, you know, I think the more we understand that, the more we know them, the more we're encouraged to do something about it.
Yes, certainly. How about the problems that they're facing in schools, too? And I know it even goes, I guess, as an end result, as far as students being either suspended or even expelled from school.
Yes. You know, it makes sense that kids who are scared, afraid, or stressed out or have high anxiety levels is going to cause disruptive behavior. That often shows up as disruptive behaviors. And so what happens more often than not is sometimes the disciplinary techniques might actually further that negative impact inadvertently. I mean, we know that kids who have are involved in the disciplinary system are more likely to drop out. They're more likely to be involved in the criminal justice system. And really, it's how do we make sure these kids feel safe, supported, and secure in their school setting? Unfortunately, we also know that school suspensions in school and out of school are disproportionate many times based on a child's race.
Now, there obviously are some encouraging signs. Where do you, with the Indiana Youth Institute, see these signs coming, and do we still need to do more?
There's always more to do. Yeah. You're absolutely right, Chris. I think what we're really encouraged about is that the Indiana Department of Education is really stepping into this space in a very thoughtful, evidence-based way that is going to be widespread. So they have come out with a new tool, the social and emotional competencies. They're all available on their website, the Indiana Department of Education. And it's really going through and training on things such as self-management, relationship skills, responsible decision-making, self-awareness, all of those things that the more we understand and the better as educators and youth workers, we all can provide those skills and teach those skills and model those skills, the more it will address some of these needs of our kids.
Now, we know that the Indiana General Assembly has put in some additional money to handle things like school safety. Are these measures, at least the opportunity for the measures, helping out as well, too?
Absolutely. It's a really wise investment because we know that for every dollar invested in programs such as the new one that IDOE is rolling out, it returns $11 in savings, most acutely from the criminal justice system, the juvenile justice system, but it also results in higher lifetime earnings and increased mental and physical health. So, again, this is a really wise investment on the state's part, and that being said, it's also going to take a while. It's not easy work, but it's worthwhile.
Now, obviously, we still have a General Assembly session that is underway. In fact, they haven't even really taken up much about the next two-year state budget. What do you folks with the Indiana Youth Institute encourage lawmakers across not only Northwest Indiana, but the rest of Indiana do to make sure that the next two-year spending plan that is going to be set up is going to provide enough money to keep things going for schools?
Right. We're always talking about the wise investment that centers around our kids, right? Every dollar that we're investing in our kids is setting our communities and our state up for future success. So, you know, whether it's right now we're talking a lot about children who are being impacted by the opioid crisis. If we don't address not just the adults that are struggling with substance use disorder, but also the kids that are in those lives, we're going to have a long-term problem, right? So a lot of the kids' solution, a lot of the kids' planning and the child investments that are being made today, we're going to see the results, and or positive or negative, over years to come. And so we're always encouraging lawmakers to understand the data, understand the challenges, help us. We're happy to provide that data and access to that data and even some analysis of it. You know, what does this mean? What does it mean? Right now, we know that some of our child hunger numbers in the state went down, and so we have less food insecure kids, but we also have more kids that are overweight and obese. So what does that mean, and what do we do about it? And, you know, we're always encouraging them to think deeper and to get real numbers and data so that we can serve our kids.
Now, we've only had a chance for a few minutes here to talk about some of these important issues and the updates, of course, too, that have come out from the Indiana Department of Education. If people are interested in finding out more, either getting caught up with the latest info or just the basic issues as well, too, how can they find out now?
Everything is always available on our website, IYI.org. The whole data book's there, the whole outline of this column and what it means for the social and emotional competencies from IDOE. There's an outline on our website, and then there's also a link to DOE, their full curriculum. So, and if you can't find it there, give us a call or shoot us an email, and we'll see what we can do to connect you with the information that you need.
Well, Tammy, thank you very much for talking about this today.
Always my pleasure. Thank you.
Tammy Silverman is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. The 2019 Valparaiso University Jazz Festival is underway this week in the Harry Union Ballroom on campus. An array of exciting performances by talented high school students, college jazz musicians, and local and national professionals like the Marco Villarreal Quartet. The creator of the Jazz Festival is Jeffrey Brown, a professor in the music department at Valparaiso University, and we spent time talking with him about the history of the festival, the performance event schedule for this year, and a little bit more about the uniquely American music spread around the world that's called jazz. What a history of 34 years for the annual Jazz Festival at Valparaiso University. And Jeff, take us through the history, what people have listened to over the decades, then come away with a better appreciation of jazz music in general, right?
Oh, for sure. We've had some excellent artists that have crossed the stage, and some of them, unfortunately, are no longer with us. Artists like Slide Hampton, Maynard Ferguson, Frank Foster, Clark Terry, Bobby Shoes, Steve Turay, Bill Watrous. It goes on and on and on. Bobby Watson, Curtis Fuller, Terrell Stafford. It's some of the biggest names in jazz, and many of them excellent jazz educators as well. We started off as a day-and-a-half festival 34 years ago, and the first guest artist internationally was the second full day of that. It was like a day-and-a-half, by Friday night and all day Saturday, was Phil Woods, who the legendary alto saxophonist and arranger and composer. And that's what we started with, and it slowly but surely gained momentum. We added the high school component of it about the fifth year in. We saw that, well, personally, I saw that most of the jazz ensembles in the high schools, every place that they would go, they'd be adjudicated, and there was no all the festivals and things like that they would go to. So I wanted to do something different for them. I wanted to put the high schools in a professional environment and kind of perform just for the sake of the music and for the joy of playing, and it's worked out great.
I guess it's really more like giving the high school bands and the college bands an opportunity to have some extended jam sessions, right?
Well, there were jam sessions, and there are every year, and they're somewhat not planned. The students get together, and they just, and sometimes it's really cool when students from different high schools get together just on a whim, and while they're in the back, in side rooms, in warm-up rooms, and things like that, there's a common, language and common different forms. Like you'll hear them playing a blues together that they've learned, or like something that they've worked with on a play along, like a Jamie Abersall play along that they all know the same tune, and ironically most of the time in the same key. And so it's a sideline to their performance on stage that they're very prepared for. And a lot of the reason because of that is because this area, and I've seen this firsthand because luckily I've been able to do a lot of traveling throughout the U.S. here, doing clinics and things like that. Northwest Indiana has some of the finer jazz educators, I believe, in the country, and they do an excellent job. And you certainly will witness that on Monday and Tuesday of the festival.
And it's, of course, it does start in with the April 1st and April 2nd. That's the opportunities that you have a chance to listen to in the Harry Union Ballroom to these local high school bands get together. And, of course, then on Tuesday of the 2nd, they get a chance to actually perform as well with the Valparaiso University Jazz Ensemble and the Vocal Ensemble. So it gives them an extra treat, as well as, I suppose, a little extra education too, right?
Yes. It's two nights of, I figured out just this year we have more bands, I think, than we ever have.
Wow.
We're gonna have over 300 high school students on the stage over April 1st and April 2nd. Washington Township, Kankakee Valley, Morgan Township, Portage High School is bringing two bands, Hobart High School, Chesterton High School, Valparaiso High School is bringing, I believe, three bands. And then there's to close the evening off on Tuesday, April 2nd, the VU Jazz Ensemble will be performing. That's the one that I direct. And there's a brand new ensemble, and which is kind of exciting when there's a new voice in this music. It's great. There's a vocal jazz ensemble that is directed by Professor Anne Marie Bice, and she's doing a great job. And it actually is a jazz combo class that is taught here on campus. But it was so popular, we thought to begin with that it was going to be just about 5 to 6 students. I think that she's got 12 students in there, which enables her to like do some vocal jazz arrangements accompanied by the jazz ensemble. So that's something new, and we're looking forward to having that as well.
Now, on Wednesday night, April 3rd, is where we get the college jazz performers busy, and we're talking faculty as well as students with, of course, the Valparaiso University Faculty Jazz Trio and the Jazz Educators Big Band. And there's a new component, I understand, too, which is called the Calumet Ridge Jazz Ensemble. Tell us about that for anybody that's not familiar with that.
Well, it's interesting because the pendulum swings with this. It's interesting, and this pendulum has swung to a really active local big band scene. And the that evening, the VU Faculty Jazz Trio starts off with like about a half an hour set at 6 o'clock, and then the Northwest Indiana Jazz Educator Big Band, which ironically the Faculty Jazz Trio is the rhythm section for, so we just kind of stay on stage, but they come up, and that's directed by myself and Bill Timmerman, who's one of the Portage High School band directors, and it's a fun group. We do this every year, and we get together, we have one rehearsal, and then we have the gig on the 3rd. And it's a lot of fun. A lot of local band directors who've kept their chops up, and we do some interesting music. Then there's the Midwest Big Band and the Calumet Ridge Jazz Ensemble, and they're made up of area musicians who just really love big band music, and they perform at different functions, and it's they're very good. It's a lot of folks who just primarily do this as their avocation, and just love of the music, and I just decided, I said, you know, we just got to give these bands a venue of a place to be recognized. And so another irony is that sometimes I know as a fact there's going to be 2 or 3 musicians that almost that play literally in each one of those bands, but that's how much they enjoy playing. So
wow. That's wonderful. We're talking with Jeff Brown, who is the creator of what is now going to be the 34th annual Valparaiso University Jazz Fest. It's coming up April 1st through the 5th on the Valparaiso University campus. And we get to the high school bands, and you'll get to hear some great performances there. Some regional bands as well with educators and students from the colleges. And now we're coming up on Thursday, April 4th. The schedule has the professionals, I guess, including some very interesting and well-known professionals, too. Besides yourself, Jeff, and we know you have with the Chicago Jazz Showcase and the Jazz Ensemble, some special guests. Tell us a little bit about Scott Burns, who you had a chance to perform with. In fact, you've actually had to create a CD with.
Yes, Scott's an excellent musician. He teaches up at Loyola and DePaul in Chicago as well. He went to school in the Cincinnati-Dayton area. He's well-known there as well as in Chicago. He's an excellent tenor saxophonist. I think that you're going to play a cut.
Yeah, we have a little clip here from the chance that he had to perform with you folks with the Jazz Ensemble here some time ago. And in fact, it's a composition of your own. Tell us about Nixter, where you came up with that, and where Scott Burns fits into it.
Well, you know, interesting, it is... You have to be careful when you say that it's a composition of mine because it's a blues.
Uh-huh.
So a blues is a very standard form of tonic sub. No, I'm not in a theory class. A 1-4 and a 5 chord, and with jazz musicians taking liberties in this 12-bar format, and I wrote the melody of it that you hear. The Nixter is a tune written about my youngest son Nicholas, and it's just got a bouncy characteristic to it, and which is somewhat indicative of him.
Let's hear a little bit of Nixter with Scott Burns and tenor sax. Now, also, too, on the program on Thursday evening, April 4th, along with Scott Burns performing, Farid Whitted is the trumpeter that is, and his colleague Tom Garling on the trombone. Tell us what they're going to be performing during that concert on April 4th.
Oh, there's literally some beautiful Thad Jones, Mel Lewis type of arrangements that we're going to be doing. There's a beautiful ballad that and a gorgeous arrangement of Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, the great Jerome Kern tune that was arranged by Don Braden, actually, when Don Braden was here as a guest artist. A lot of various styles and just great tunes featuring three of Chicago's finest jazz musicians.
Now, Friday, April 5th, the crowd that comes for the 34th Annual Jazz Fest for the performances at the Howrah Union Ballroom on Friday the 5th will be treated by the Jazz Festival Concert, and you have, as the opening act, the Marco Villarreal Quartet. Tell us what Marco brings to the jazz scene here.
Well, Marco's a brilliant guitarist, and he's a product of Northwest Indiana. I don't know where he lives now. I know he lives locally here. But he plays literally around the United States. He plays with Frank Russell's band in Chicago, and he does a lot of solo acts around here. But he's a really interesting, both straight ahead and fusion-ish type of guitarist, and he'll be doing all of his own original arrangements, and it'll be an exciting way to open that evening up.
And Stefan Harris and Blackout is also going to be on the bill as well on Friday night. People that aren't familiar with Stefan's music and Blackout's music, tell us about that.
Well, Stefan's for the past 3 to 4 years, he's been ranked number one jazz vibraphonist in Downbeat magazine. And he was on the cover of Downbeat magazine about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And he's just a phenomenal. He'll be playing both vibraphone and marimba with this group. The group spans the gamut of repertoire. He'll be doing all original material, but it's very hard to pigeonhole him into a category. He does gorgeous ballads. He does really raucous fusion. He can do some straight ahead stuff. He has some excellent musicians with him. It'll actually be a quintet that will be on stage. And so I would truly, if you want to come out and hear a younger, brilliant musician and educator too, he's going to be doing a master class at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, which is open to the public. And the master class will be, in the Union Ballroom where mm-hmm. the concerts are all, and then I would just strongly encourage you to come out and hear a very unique ensemble.
Well, tickets are available for this 34th annual Valparaiso University Jazz Fest, available at the Howrah Union box office, and you can get them. You also check the website too, vu.edu, for more information. Would you say, Jeff, that for all the years that you've had a chance to shape the Jazz Fest, that these are some of the best years that have come along, even though we don't have some of the big names that have unfortunately passed us over the years, but we have these up-and-coming people that seem to be making jazz and making people's appreciation of jazz, whichever form it may happen to be, more important every year.
True, and I've always said it's interesting if you got 10 people in a room and asked them what jazz was, you would get 10 different answers, from traditional to swing to fusion to funk to all of these various subgenres that have helped define jazz over the years. And that's what I've attempted to do with this festival over the years, is to try to be non-categorical. There are traditional jazz festivals. There's like the Bix Beiderbecke thing, and there's all kinds of different types of festivals that they have an isolated, somewhat repertoire, for lack of another way of
putting it. Sort of following in the history of like the Newport Jazz Festival and the other ones that have come in the past.
Sure, although Newport's has a very varied, eclectic lineup as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's been one of the goals of mine to keep it open for that, because that helps expose an audience to what's new and what's cutting edge, and then indeed at the same time respecting the strong history of this music, because it's truly America's only indigenous musical art form.
Well, Jeff Brown, thank you very much for being with us to talk about this. It's the 2019, the 34th annual Jazz Fest coming up at Valparaiso University, April 1st through the 5th on campus. And we appreciate you spending time and showing your appreciation not only to the public about this great music, but helping keep it alive with all the young people, not only helping those on colleges, but also high schools as well, too, with the seminars and the sessions that you get to do with them. Thanks for spending time with us to talk about it.
Chris, thank you for your support. I appreciate it.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Well, you're certainly feeling a little tight of cash at the pump. Well, so is the rest of the country these days. Petroleum analyst Patrick DeHaan with GasMoney.com tells us that gas prices are up in all 50 states, but the biggest jumps have been in 7 states, including Indiana. He says Indiana's average price for unleaded gasoline this week is at $2.69 a gallon. That's about 2.5 cents more than it was this time last week.
The climate at gas pumps across the country remained less than upbeat, with 66% of stations nationwide selling for over $2.50 per gallon.
The most expensive gas in the Hoosier State today is in Indianapolis at $2.89 a gallon, and the least expensive as of earlier this morning is a $2.07, and that was found at a Speedway station in West Lafayette. A bill that would create a pilot program to store carbon dioxide underground is going back to the Indiana Senate. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel tells us the bill passed the House last week and it's undergone a lot of changes.
The original proposal would have allowed companies to store CO2 underground as long as they got consent from owners of about half the land. This current bill creates a pilot program that allows one company to take ownership of the land through eminent domain. Wabash Valley Resources LLC wants to build an ammonia production facility in Terre Haute and store its CO2 emissions. But activists with the Citizens Action Coalition worry injecting CO2 could cause earthquakes and pollute drinking water. That's why Executive Director Kerwin Olson urged the state to study CO2 storage before making policy changes.
How can we sort of declare that the underground storage of carbon dioxide is a benefit to the public and the welfare of the state of Indiana when we haven't even studied the issue yet?
The author of the bill, Republican Senator John Ford, says it also promises a thorough study of the effects of carbon storage by the State Department of Natural Resources. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
Indiana ranks second in the nation for its rate of child abuse victims. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Becca Costello tells us more in an annual report that's come out from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
The report says more than 18 in every 1,000 Hoosier children were victims of abuse in fiscal year 2017. That's more than double the national average, and it's second only to neighboring Kentucky, where 22 in 1,000 children were abused that year. Indiana also ranks fifth in the nation for the rate of child abuse and neglect deaths. At the same time, the Indiana Department of Child Services response time has gone down. The report says DCS responds to a tip within about 3 days. That's on par with the national average. Drug abuse was a risk factor in about a quarter of the state's abuse and neglect cases. That's a 30% increase in 3 years. DCS is asking lawmakers for nearly $300 million more for their annual budget. State leaders have shifted dollars over the last couple of years because of a huge uptick in cases. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Becca Costello.
Time again for Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts are Harry Vandeveld, CEO, and Pat Popa, board member. I don't know why I did it in that order necessarily. I should have had ladies first.
Most definitely.
And both affiliated with Humane Indiana, which is the new name for the Humane Society of
Calumet area.
Of the Calumet area.
Yeah.
I once had sent a memorial gift to you before you were there, Harry.
Okay.
I got the wrong Humane Society and I got the wrong animal. I got the right dead person. But anyway, be that as it may.
I'm sure they took the gift.
Oh, yes. I received a thank you acknowledgement, yes. In any event, I had to apologize, though, to the survivor with whom I was acquainted. So anyhow, you're doing a nifty art thing with Humane Indiana. Which one of you is going to tell us about it?
So I'll tee it up, and okay. Then I'll get out of the way.
Okay.
We changed our name and our branding a couple years ago from Humane Society, Calumet area, to mm-hmm. Humane Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is that a lot of folks think of us as the shelter on 45th Street.
Mm-hmm.
We are more than that in the fact that we also have a wildlife rehabilitation center and an education center in Valparaiso that a lot of folks don't know about.
Mm.
So we have 28 acres in Valparaiso, where last year we rehabilitated 1,800 wild animals from 23 counties in the state of Indiana.
Are these animals that fall in people's window wells and
yes,
sort of
exactly.
Thing?
Yep.
I've had that happen.
88 species of birds alone were treated last year. Yep. We currently have a bald eagle who's in our flight cage learning how to fly again.
Fantastic.
So what we did
and they rehabilitated a snowy owl last year, or snow owl last year.
And so in October of last year, we had a Festival of the Owls, since we have, as ambassador animals, animals that are rehabilitated but can no longer survive in the wild become ambassador animals. Those animals, we have six of the indigenous species of owls as ambassador animals.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a Festival of the Owls, sold out.
Mm-hmm.
That was the spark that ignited the fire in Pat Popa to say, as a board member, what we really need is a public art initiative that will bring artists as well as individuals who love animals together.
And Pat Popa, I should say, was one of the founders of the County Seats Public Art Project.
Correct.
That we had in Northwest Indiana about 10 years ago, was it? How many years?
Oh, 13 now. It's 06, correct.
Yeah, and that project brought this sort of amorphic lima bean seats that people could actually sit on, and they were all painted by area artists, mm-hmm. and they appeared throughout Lake Porter and LaPorte counties.
Lake Porter and LaPorte.
And the funds that were derived from that went into a special fund so that South Shore Arts can give prizes for our kids from those three counties every mm-hmm. year for the Tri-County School Show.
Mm-hmm.
So now you came up with this new idea, Pat.
Well,
tell
yes.
us about that.
So being on the board, I actually had lunch with one of the county seat sponsors
mm-hmm.
who is now very into art. And he said, you know, we just don't know how to get our art out in the public. How do we, you know, and I thought, gosh, why not get the art community and the animal community together,
mm-hmm.
two very passionate
mm-hmm.
groups of people,
mm-hmm.
and get the name of Humane Indiana out there. And it's, and I've done these before, as you know. I started with the Downtown Ducks in Highland.
Oh, that's right.
And then we did the County Seats, and I actually mentored Crown Point with the Bulldogs after we did, if you remember that.
Yes, of course.
The Stewards of the Square did that, but I mentored them through that after doing the Ducks. And we thought, why not do something like this to make it way more public and get people, bring it to the people.
And tell us what our theme is.
It is All You Need Is Love.
All You Need Is Love.
So we have an owl sculpture. It's 4.5 feet tall. It's a beautiful sculpture. So it's a blank canvas for artists to do whatever they conjure up.
So if an artist wants to be a part of this project, what do they need to do?
They just need to contact Humane Indiana and get on the list.
Good.
So we've already got interested sponsors, and we're starting to put sponsors and artists together. Sometimes sponsors already have artists that they know or that are on staff.
Sure.
And we also have a special school component of this project, which was thought of by one of our board members, Scott Filler from Apex Construction. And he came up with an idea because we have the Wildlife Center in Valpo, and they do a wildlife education program for kids, that if we get schools to sponsor an owl, they will keep the sculpture, and then they will also get a two-hour education program where they will bring the wild animals to the school and do an education program.
Oh, nice.
So that's really exciting.
So we're running out of time, sadly, because this is a really interesting subject. And when will we start to see owls appear on the streets of Northwest Indiana?
They will appear the middle of July. And I just want to say one more thing, that we started this project with a generous gift from the Arlene Heward Estate, a woman who passed away, and their estate, she happened to love owls. And when they found out about this project, they just really wanted to be a part of it. And they helped us get the seed money to get started with our prototype.
So if you want to be a sponsor, and so in other words, host an owl at your business or wherever it would be.
HumaneIndiana.org.
HumaneIndiana.org.
It's the most fun you'll ever have advertising your business, I guarantee.
All right. Thank you, Pat, and thank you for Harry for being here to tell us about All You Need Is Love.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And you can catch this conversation and other conversations on Eye on the Arts on our website right now at lakeshorepublicradio.org. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.